I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. We'll talk food now with my guest Nick Saul. I'll ask him about food security, food insecurity, food banks, poverty, and more. He's an activist and the founding president of Community Food Centres Canada and the author of a new book, The Stop, How the Fight for Good Food Transformed a Community and Inspired a Movement. The Stop was a food bank in a Toronto neighborhood, and Mr. Saul helped transform it into a community kitchen and garden, a farmer's market, as well as providing food hampers and drop-in meals. It's a fascinating story, and I'll get him to tell us about this new project that wants to replicate the development of food centers like The Stop across the country. We take food for granted, and despite the wealth of our cities, there are millions of Canadians going hungry and getting sick because of a lack of access to healthy food. And close to a million Canadians use food banks. Nick Saul's experience suggests change is possible. He's written this book with Andrea Curtis. Visit cfccanada.ca for more information. Nick Saul was the executive director of the community, of the Stop Community Food Centre in Toronto from 1998 to 2012. He has received many awards, including the Jane Jacobs Prize and the Queen's Jubilee Medal. This book is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in Vancouver today, Nick Saul. Mr. Saul, good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
So Andrea Curtis, she's a pretty good writer herself. She's known as a writer. What was her involvement with your work at The Stop?
Well, I don't know if you mentioned this, but Andrea happens to be my wife,
right,
as well.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the day when I arrived at The Stop in 1998, it was a really small, under-resourced place, and we looked for communications help wherever we could get it. And as you've mentioned, my wife is a very accomplished writer, and she was extraordinarily helpful in getting the word out about The Stop on a volunteer basis. And if I had a quarter for every time we sat in our living room trying to figure out tags for the newsletter, or, you know, food for thought or recipe for change, you know, I'd be a very rich man donating to lots of nonprofits. So she's been an amazing ally, and when it came time to say, I think when we had a bit more stability in the organization, we actually hired someone who helped us with communications. She said, if this book ever gets written, I'm doing it with you.
Mm-hmm.
And we survived. We're happily married, and we're really proud of this recent birth, which is our book.
Yeah, it's a very interesting read in terms of what all happened and what you all did. In the book you write, our food should never make us sick, damage our planet, or divide us as citizens. Why does it, and what needs to happen so it doesn't?
Well, I mean, I don't know where to start with that question. I mean, maybe the easiest way is to say that in this country, 3 million Canadians go hungry or are food insecure, which means they're not entirely sure where their next meal is going to come from, or they're missing meals so that their kids can eat. And so from an equity fairness side, we have a serious, serious problem. And when you look at it from an environmental lens, most people say that about a third of our greenhouse gases and pollution are directly connected to the way we move food from field to table. And then, so that's a problem. And then if you look at it through kind of a healthcare lens, I think about 50 cents of every dollar in most provinces is spent on healthcare, and a good chunk of that is spent on diet-related illnesses, such as diabetes, obesity, heart disease, cancer, et cetera. So these are major problems in our current food system. And we have been rather passive about thinking about food, where we kind of just take it for granted, and most people view it as a straightforward commodity. And I would say absolutely not. I mean, if you think about food, if you eat it with others, you build community through it, you can express your background and culture. If you eat good food, it creates life and health. And if you grow food sustainably without chemicals, it nourishes the soil and the planet. And I think maybe most importantly, or at least equally importantly, is that if everyone has access to good food, you have safer, more inclusive neighborhoods. So, you know, the idea behind spreading the community food center idea was that a lot of those stats I just spoke about can be quite debilitating. It's like, how do you begin? How do you take on some of those issues? And the Community Food Center, our sense is that it is a very tangible, tactile place in a community where people can come together, both low-income community members who are struggling in a significant way, and more middle-class community that is actually very conscious, and kind of that vote with your fork mentality that Michael Pollan speaks about, where people are making, you know, choices in the food system that are better for the planet and themselves, et cetera. So how do we create spaces that reflect the future that we want to see, which is obviously a future that is healthier, more equitable and fair and more sustainable? And so the Community Food Center idea is like a vessel by which we can create new conversations about food, and not see it as simply something you eat to get you from one spot to the other, but it has significant implications for our health and our planet.
I'll ask you about the impediments to change that you're seeing us face today. But let's go back to the stop and how it started for you. I guess you ended up there in 1998, is that right?
That's right. I began there.
What had you been doing before?
Well, I had worked in a number of settings, mostly with very low-income community members. I worked in public housing, organizing tenants in a falling apart public housing community, and we supported them to become a co-op so that they could take more charge of their community. And then I worked with homeless men for quite a while, guys who were living outside and then moved into a shelter, and then we were trying to support them to move into affordable and permanent housing. And then I worked in politics as well in Ontario. But most of my experience has been working in the NGO sector on issues of poverty and low income, and trying to figure out a way to support those who are most kind of affected, the poor themselves, to have a voice in creating change. Because I think change happens because you fight for it. You know, change doesn't get given to you. I mean, think of the women's right to vote or the end of apartheid, whatever. I mean, these are things that you have to mobilize around and change.
So you get to the stop in 1998, and what was it like then? Was it like what we think of as a traditional food bank, say?
Yeah, it was small. It was falling apart, kind of stained ceiling tiles, paint coming off the wall. I'm not even going to get into the bug situation, but you know, physically, it was a very difficult place to be in. And then from the food side of it, because that's all we did, it was a food bank. We handed out food that was not very healthy at all, and you know, dented cans and tuna and pork and beans and you know, bananas that were so overripe you could practically drink them. I referenced that in the book. So it was a place where a lot of people, most people, everyone had to check their humanity at the door before coming in. It was tough. It was a place where you kept your eyes on the ground.
Yeah. So you obviously have changed it over the time that you were there. Where did you get the idea to change the way that we look at this in terms of not look at it as a commodity, a transactional, etc.?
Yeah. Well, I think that there were a couple of things that were going on, and certainly there was this early thinking about food in a very different way that was driven by the Michael Pollans and the Supersize Me and Eric Schlosser and Fast Food Nation. So there was certainly an awareness that food is linked to health, community, the environment, and justice. And so there was kind of a new theoretical framework that was growing called community food security, which kind of viewed food in this holistic way. And also there were lots of groups trying to take that theory and apply it in practice in a place-based setting. So okay, if that's the theory, then how do we create organizations that actually get at these issues, not in a siloed format, but that work across each other and try and create the change that we all want to see? So, there, you know, that was happening. But I tell you, the biggest impetus for change was simply listening to our community. We spent a lot of time in those early years creating fora where people could come and just say, look, I do not want to be a passive recipient of food charity. I mean, we knew that the food bank that we had there was not reducing hunger, it wasn't supporting people's health, and it certainly wasn't creating a pathway out of poverty. And it was stigmatizing people, and it was certainly dividing us as citizens between the haves and the have-nots. And I think it also was supporting people to think, oh, you know, the problem's being taken care of, the food bank's taking care of it, where we know full well that the most food insecure people in this country are those who use food banks. And, you know, you referenced the number, 1 million people go to food banks. Well, I've talked about 3 million people who are food insecure, so there are lots of folks. That's just to indicate how many who are struggling will not go to a food bank because of the stigma. So, I mean, those early days were all about listening, and people essentially said that they wanted to connect with their neighbors, they wanted to be part of creating a better neighborhood. I don't think they actually said, I want to be a cook or a gardener per se, but like they wanted to be agents in their lives, and so we were a food organization. And we decided to start to build programming like community gardens, like community kitchens, healthy drop-in meal programs that allowed people to come in and be who they wanted to be, right, in a very respectful space. So I haven't talked about how, you know, over the years we spent a lot of time improving physically the space. I'm a big believer that the physical determines the social, and so we want to create spaces that are, feel good, that you feel like you matter in them, and so that's what we've been doing.
What's that term in architecture? Form follows function.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't believe that for a long time, and when I worked organizing tenants in public housing, you know, I saw the way the community was planned and these open areas that kind of no one knew what to do with, and they often got taken over by folks who were not doing the best things in them, and so similarly, I mean, I think twofold, like the physical does determine the social, that you want to have really inspiring places. But I would also say that, and this gets back to the quality of the food back in the old days of the stop, you want to create food where when people look at it, they're like, someone has taken a lot of care with this. Mm-hmm. The ingredients are good. Someone cares about me. And I think people see that gets reflected back, and they say, well, I matter. Mm-hmm. Like, I can do something, and you kind of look up from that meal, and when there's lots of other ways that you can get involved, you start to get a sense of, yes, you know, I'm hopeful, because I do believe that hope and self-worth are two key ingredients to both individual and community change. So, you know, again, you need to create places where those things can rise to the surface.
And on a superficial level, for people that are reading this book, one learns that you can have good food on a tight or small budget, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's about prioritizing that. If you don't name it, then it's not going to happen. So, you know, within the NGO sector, we decided at the stop back in the day to say, we think healthy food is what our community deserves. So we created a healthy food fund, and we went out like crazy to raise money to ensure that we could purchase with our values. We could support a local food economy, for example, rather than, you know, kind of industrial food. We went out and found small-scale family farmers who were growing food in a way that wasn't about export, commodity, monoculture, chemicals. We wanted to find people who were growing in a different way and make sure that that food was getting to our most vulnerable citizens in our community. If you don't name something, chances are you're not gonna be able to get there.
What were some of the challenges that you encountered along the way? Because unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, the marketplace is commoditized food, and also charities and how food banks operate.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that. I mean, there are many challenges.
I mean, on a social level, I mean, did you encounter challenges from, say, the perception that people had, you know, that clients had, people in the community had?
No, I mean, I think that, I mean, if there certainly was some defensiveness within the food bank sector, and I want to make it really clear that the stuff that we're talking about is not trying to villainize food bankers. I mean, I think any food banker would say that private food charity is not going to solve hunger or poverty in our country. I think what we're trying to do is channel that compassion and sense of caring that is reflected in that food bank response into a more progressive project. So, you know, I that's what we're trying to do. And if And certainly there are other food banks across the country who are, you know, saying, hey, let's do, you know, we have some green space around our center. Why don't we do a community gardening program? Or, you know, we're in a church and we have a big community kitchen. Let's do kitchen groups. But it's pretty small and ephemeral, and they're all under-resourced. And so what we're bringing to the table is, you know, a sense of kind of a diversity of programming that falls in the areas of dignified emergency and skill building around food, so gardens and kitchens. And then the really a strong emphasis on education and civic engagement. I think, you know, at a moment when so much of our public space is being privatized, and there's a lot of finger pointing, particularly at the poor, like, come on, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, you know, you're a poor budgeter, you know, this is a character flaw, which is all nonsense. That's not why people are poor. We need to create spaces that not only meet people where they're at with their basic needs, but also allow people to think about some of the bigger issues that drive, not only think about, but to be actively engaged in the bigger issues that drive their vulnerability in the first place. That's, you know, low minimum wages and social assistance rates that don't measure up, or lack of affordable housing and child care. So, you know, our humble contribution to turning the tide on this, I think, rather simplistic and not very creative response to vulnerability in low-income communities around food, which is the food bank, into this community food center, is I think, catching some fire. People are excited about it, and, you know, I'm hopeful it's, we're not trying to have a, you know, a fight in any way. We're trying to, I think the book is a very hopeful book, because we were a food bank, and now we are a completely different species altogether.
And that's part of your work, I guess, with Community Food Centers Canada. You want to replicate this throughout the country?
That's right. We thought that we could maybe build other community food centers off the side desk of the stop, and it just became too complicated. And so last August, a bunch of us moved from the stop and established this new organization called Community Food Centers Canada, and it's tasked with building 15 centers across the country over the next 5 years. We're trying to do 3 a year, and a couple weeks ago we announced the next 3 sites on top of the stop, obviously in Toronto, and then we have 2 others in Ontario, one in Perth and one in Stratford. But we announced 2 weeks ago one in Winnipeg, in the northwest part of Winnipeg, quite a hard scrabble neighborhood, and one in Dartmouth, North Dartmouth, and another one in Toronto in Regent Park. So we're trying to support those centers with some you know, lots of experience around programming and how you do it, evaluation, fundraising, and some dollars as well. And we're always looking for good organizations that we can partner with, because that, you know, if we're coming to a town, we're not going to just start from ground zero. We want to work with a relationship and build a community food center out of that existing organization. And we spend a lot of time trying to figure out what the constellation of programming will be in that community, because it's not a one-size-fits-all. You have to sort out what is going to work best in Vancouver or Kamloops or Saskatoon or wherever. You don't want to come and just say this is a cookie-cutter approach.
I understand that you need to raise $20 million. You've raised about 8, is that right?
We've raised 11 so far of startup capital, and we have 9 to go. And we're excited about it. It's a mix of public and private dollars, and I think ultimately we feel once we've built the model and, you know, we've got the measurements down and we have wind in our sails, that we want to make the case that this is something that government should be supporting. When I, you know, all those statistics I talked about earlier, whether it's around poverty reduction or environmental degradation or healthcare costs, those are things that obviously our tax dollars are very much involved with. And so we're trying to create a model that is preventative and upstream, and we hope at some point the government looks over and says, wow, you seem to have some answers to some of these big, intractable problems we have out there. Let's find a way to support what you're doing.
What have you found in terms of a government response? Is there a reticence on the part of governments at certain levels?
No, I mean, I think that there, my sense is government doesn't lead on these things. I mean, a lot of the good ideas come out of civil society, and so I think you have to, and I'm relatively firm on this, that we can build this outside and then get it to where we think it needs to be in terms of, you know, how are we reducing hunger? How are we improving health? How are we driving increased consumption of fruits and vegetables, reducing social isolation? I mean, these are all kind of indicators that we want to track. And I think that if we can build those smartly, government will walk in and they'll say, we want to partner with you. So I don't see any reticence. I mean, government is kind of battening the hatches almost everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So if we do have something that is really making a difference, then I'm hopeful that they will look at it and say, okay, we want to be part of that. That's a key plan of ours, or kind of, if I'm thinking aspirationally, that we do think government needs very much to be involved in the delivery on the right to food in this country.
Now, you obviously have a salary as a president of community food centers when you were executive director of the STOP, but there must be something that you get out of this beyond that. It seems like difficult work, but at the same time awfully rewarding. Has it been?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I wake up in the morning every day wanting to go to work because the work is important, and I've been fortunate enough to see over many years the impact that some of the work that myself and my colleagues are doing. So, you know, when a healthy baby is born to a low-income mom in our Healthy Beginnings program, which is a perinatal nutrition initiative at the STOP, or when a new immigrant connects with others for the first time while working in our gardens, or, you know, sharing his knowledge, or, you know, when a 10-year-old kid in our after-school program is turned on to healthy food and the environment through cooking and gardening, I mean, yeah, change is happening all the time, and I want to be part of that. So I don't know where else I could be, quite frankly.
Does it astonish you, though, Nick, that as wealthy as we are in the cities that you and I live in, that there are still these problems? There is still poverty. There is still hunger. That you'd think that we'd have solved these things by now. Or is it just a silly idea?
Well, no. I mean, we have a... I mean, how much do you want to talk about a capitalist system that is all about productivity and profitability, and we have an enormous wealth gap between the rich and the poor, and we have, you know, very weak labor laws, and, you know, our minimum wages are far too small, and I think we beggar those who are poor by not supporting them when they're in trouble. I mean, I don't understand why, when someone who is working a couple jobs, fighting to put food on their table, that, you know, we wouldn't have a conversation about minimum wages being too low. Or if someone does have to turn to social assistance, which is kind of the income support of last resort, why we wouldn't want them to be healthy and live with some dignity when they're receiving that social assistance check, so that they can, in fact, bounce back into the economy. You know, we have an economy also that produces very vulnerable jobs. I mean, the STOP is located in a community that used to have a lot of manufacturing jobs that were well paid and often unionized, and they were permanent jobs, and a lot of those factories have been replaced by those big box stores that, you know, people are kind of employed seasonally on and off, and they don't get paid enough. So you know, I'm a big believer that, you know, this stuff doesn't happen overnight. So, there is the fight that's on, right, to try and create a more equitable society, and ultimately to get across that we are all social beings, and that we're all connected, and we're only as strong as our weakest link. So from a moral perspective, I think when we have the level of poverty that we see in our cities and in our country, I mean, it diminishes us all to have such deprivation. And, you know, I'm not even talking about poverty from an economic perspective, in lost productivity, ballooning healthcare budgets, and unrealized potential, and unsafe neighborhoods. I mean, those are real costs that, I mean, there's a lot of good research that shows poverty costs upwards of, you know, $80, $90 billion. So from an economic perspective, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense outside of the moral one. But I'm, you know, I keep moving because I come across people who are doing inspiring work in their space, in their community, whether it's in British Columbia or Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, who are saying, no, we need to have fairer, more connected communities. And those, you know, those voices need to grow and be nurtured. And we do have lots of examples in our society where a societal consensus was built around issues such as, you know, if you take healthcare, a limited way housing, certainly education, where we felt that just leaving all of these things to the market as unmediated is a problem, and that our tax dollars need to step in and make a difference. And I would argue that that's the same for our food system. That you know, why don't we have a national school nutrition program? Yeah. Like it's insane. It boggles my mind when we know that we pay for kids who are going to school hungry and can't learn and can't move on in all sorts of other ways. Well, let's make sure that when a kid walks into a school, that they have at least one really good meal. And every kid in our country should have that right. So we fight, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
We build places where like-minded people can come together and understand that the individual struggles in communities are linked to you know, broader public policy change. And we are always trying to animate those changes in that public realm.
This conversation gives us a lot to think about. Nick, good luck with this book and all of your endeavors. I hope a lot of people buy this book and get hip to all this.
I appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
The website, cfccanada.ca. The book is called The Stop, How the Fight for Good Food Transformed a Community and Inspired a Movement. Random House is its publisher. It's co-author Nick Saul on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.